Welcome to Scott Bennett's Global Great Awakenings. Scott's on special assignment in St. Petersburg, Russia. I, Jim Fetzer, am very glad to be here with you today. We have multiple developments at the conference. Vladimir Putin has made many important points, which I hope will be sobering for the West, including warning that Russia could give long-range weapons to others to strike the West. I've heard reports that a special small flotilla of Russian ships are in the Caribbean. He's making stops along the way in relation to Cuba, Mexico, Venezuela, all of which might very well be provided with Russian missiles. Putin warned Germany Wednesday the use of its weapons to strike targets inside Russia would mark a dangerous step, and that Moscow could in turn provide long-range weapons to others to strike Western targets. Such action by the West will further undermine international security and could lead to very serious problems, all of which have been driven by the West by its abuse of international law and relations between Russia and Ukraine, where the West is intervening apparently out of greed to control the natural resources of Ukraine. Meanwhile, very disturbing, Russia has declared the United States to be an enemy state for the first time amid strains over Ukraine. Russian President Putin's press secretary, Peskov's remarks come after former American intel officer and UN arms inspector Scott Ritter was prevented from visiting St. Petersburg and his passport confiscated. Responding to this event, Pesky told reporters, "The latest manifestation of the rabid campaign to stop Americans from communicating with Russia would only be understandable, would only make sense, if the move had any connection to his former intelligence status. We are now an enemy country for them just as they are for us." A reputable Russian investigator, the website Agent Stav, according to that site, neither Peskov nor Putin have ever referred to the United States or other unfriendly countries as Russia's enemies in the past. Ritter, a former Marine Corps intel officer, informed TASC he was taken from a flight from New York to Istanbul intending to attend the St. Petersburg conference. He claimed authorities provide no rationale for blocking him, adding they were complying with orders from the State Department, no doubt emanating from Antony Blinken, who represents himself internationally as a Jew rather than as the American Secretary of State. The Kremlin shift in language, now classifying America as an enemy, comes after President Biden authorized Ukraine to deploy American-supplied weapons to attack targets in Russia, which was a very bad idea. Last week, the Biden admin stated it worked at lightning speed to allow Kiev to use its weapons to strike specific targets within Russia. The Kremlin earlier referred to U.S. and other Western nations that have backed and weaponized Ukraine while imposing sanctions as unfriendly states or as opponents. Back in March, Peskov stated Russia objected to U.S. politicians for disrespecting their president, but added, "There's no anti-American sentiment in Moscow," expressing optimism. He even went on to say, "Sooner or later, the realization of people of America and Russia are not enemies will eventually come." He's right about that. The people of Russia and the people of America are not enemies. But the fact of the matter is, the governments of the West have made themselves enemies of Russia, and Russia, of necessity, must take measures necessary to protect and defend its national security from the onslaught that continues to this day. Meanwhile, Putin raises the specter, really deliberate recalling to mind of the Cuban Missile Crisis by virtue of this modest flotilla visiting the Caribbean. The Admiral Gorshkov frigate, the Kazan nuclear power cruise missile submarine, the academic Pushmet replacement whaler, and the Nikolai Chekhov rescue dub are the four vessels scheduled to arrive in Cuba this week. They're expected to make a port call in Havana between June 12th and 17th before heading south to Venezuela later in the month. The U.S. think tank, Institute for the Study of War, quoted the Russian Ministry of Defense, which stated the objective was to ensure a Russian naval presence in an operationally important area of the ocean. Thursday, Putin spoke at the International Forum, made a point to mention Russia's nuclear doctrine, observing, look what it says. If someone's actions threaten our sovereignty and territorial integrity, we consider it possible for us to use all means at our disposal. This should not be taken lightly or superficially. The assessment noted Russia's decision to visit countries with historically strained U.S. relations, such as Cuba and Venezuela, is aimed at persuading the U.S. to self-detour, to draw itself back, to not enact policies offering further support for Ukraine. Monday, it was reported Ukraine had used U.S. weapons to strike targets inside Russia. A senior official claimed it was used for the purpose of defending Kharkov, Ukraine's second largest city. But bear in mind, that's not all Zelensky will use those weapons to do, alas. Here's Scott Ritter talking before his attempt to fly to St. Petersburg, where he was taken off his plane at JFK in New York. Listen carefully to what he has to say about the expectation that nuclear war could break out by mid-June. Mid-June, today being the 11th of June.
How are you tonight, Scott? Are you raring to go, or are you tired? What's the condition over there at Shea Ritter?
Oh no, we've made all the preparations. I mean, this trip, I'm excited about it, but I'm also a little nervous, not because of the trip we're getting ready to take, but because of the situation we find ourselves in the world today. I don't know how many historians are watching tonight, but if you are a historian, understand that we're in a situation today that's orders of magnitude more dangerous than the Cuban Missiles Crisis at its height. We are on the cusp of nuclear war. It could happen right now during this program. That's how stupid this entire thing is. It could happen while we're flying over to Russia. It could happen while we're in Russia. And some people would say, then why the hell are you going on the trip? And to be honest, I asked myself that same question. Why not just stay home, hang out with my family, and wait for it all to end? Because there, if I were a betting man, I could go and find different odds and make money off of this. Because this is a wager that I would take, that there would be a nuclear war by the middle of June. It doesn't mean it's 100%, doesn't mean it's 90%, but it ain't zero. It ain't even close to 0%. It's over 50% right now. There's over 50% chance there will be a nuclear war by mid-June. Because you factor in the stupidity of the Western leadership. You got Joe Biden greenlighting the use of American weapons to strike Russia when Russia says that's an act of war. You have President Macron doing the same thing, Schroeder doing the same thing, all of Europe doing the same thing, as if it's no big deal to attack Russia. It's a huge deal to attack Russia. It's as big as it gets. And then NATO says, well, these are sovereign decisions made by sovereign nations. It's not a NATO decision. Oh, really? So when Russia strikes these sovereign nations, as Russia will, is NATO going to make a move on Article 5? Big question, because I think Dmitry Medvedev, who's a former president who sits at the right hand of Putin on the National Security Council, said clearly, if you implement Article 5, we're going to assume that you're going to attack us, and then we're going to nuke you. Boom, bam, bang, gone, finished. We have senior, Russian policymakers, influencers, who are saying that Russia should do an actual nuclear explosion. Have the cameras out there and just blow one up above ground and show the whole world and tell NATO, that's you. That would be the nice thing for Russia to do. And in fact, I would encourage Russia to do that. Screw the test ban treaties. What good are treaties? The West doesn't respect them. The West doesn't care. The West thinks Russia's bluffing. So people say, well, then why go? Well, let me tell you why. Because we're going to Russia to have a conversation with the Russian people. And that conversation is going to be about the very things we're talking about here and about the prospects for peace. And there's a chance that the conversations we're going to have will be heard by senior members of the Russian government. And I want to make sure that before the Russians make the decision to use nuclear weapons, that maybe they heard Scott Ritter have a conversation with some Russian people about the prospects for peace, about giving the American people a chance, about one by exhausting every option short of war before going to war. That you don't want to write America off yet, that there are people in America whose lives are worth living, are worth saving, just like there are people who in Russia whose lives are worth living and saving. And maybe, just maybe, instead of rushing to do that which you would have every right to do, take a pause for the cause. Take a deep breath. Wait till tomorrow. Then we'd saved it. We saved the world by one day. And then if we can do it again the next day, and the next day, and the next day, just keep having these conversations, hoping that the Russian leadership is tuning in and listening. And maybe, just maybe, collectively, we can buy enough time for sanity to prevail in the West. And they back down on this. You know, in the middle of June, Zelensky is going to have this peace conference in Switzerland. It's going to fail. It's already going to fail. But you see, one of the reasons why the West is doing what it's doing right now is there's a perception that's fueled by all our great friends, Ann Applebaum and all those Russian experts who say Russia's bluffing, that Russia is desperately looking for an off-ramp. Why would they say that? I don't know, because Vladimir Putin's government said, we're open to negotiations. They just have to be realistic. Well, Zelensky's not about realistic negotiations. Zelensky's about imposing this fantasy outcome on Russia, which he can't do through use of force. He needs the West to engage, to intervene. And so this is the last gambit. Between now and the Swiss summit, Zelensky is going to be pushing every button possible, and all of his little pathetic Chihuahua nations in the Baltics and Poland and elsewhere are going to be barking to his tune. And that empowers Macron, that empowers Schultz, that empowers Biden to say, maybe we're on to something here. If we just push Russia a little bit, make Russia know that the cost they're going to pay for continuous war is too high, that Russia has to come to the table, even though they weren't invited to the table in Switzerland. That's the hope. They're misreading the Russians. The Russians aren't saying we're ready to go come to the table at all costs. The Russians are saying we're ready to come to a table that we dictate the outcome, that we've won this war and we're willing to end this war now through some sort of negotiation, but it has to be reality-based. The West is taking the advice of people who don't know Russia, who don't understand Russia, which is another reason why we have to go to Russia. so that we can experience it. We can collect this data. We can bring it back with us. And, you know, through various film products, a documentary film that we hope to make, things of that nature, to educate the American people about the reality of Russia, so that in November, maybe the American people can put some pressure on whomever we elect to represent us in higher office to make peace with Russia, not seek war with Russia.
Now, this is one of the most sane, rational voices addressing the Russia-Ukraine war. He's clearly a voice for peace. Why, therefore, would Antony Blinken have not wanted him to travel to St. Petersburg to share his insights? It can only be because he and the powers he represents, the Rothschild banking empire, do not want peace with Russia. They want war. Recall, as I've observed before, the World Economic Forum has declared the New World Order cannot move forward without Ukraine. This, therefore, is not just a battle over that particular region of geography. It's a battle over the fate of the world. And how could you have a peace conference in which your opponent, Russia, is not even invited to participate? Clearly a fraud. China, who was invited, has, in the absence of Russia, declined. It's ill-fated from the beginning, just as Scott suggests. Meanwhile, Putin observes, we wouldn't even need nukes to defeat a defenseless Europe. After months of dropping veiled threats about nukes, after he ordered his invasion of Ukraine over 2 years ago, which, of course, as I've explained, was defensive, to protect the Donbass from an all-out slaughter that was about to be launched by Kiev, just as vicious as the Israeli slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza, where Putin acted properly to intervene, is now saying Europe is defenseless. Russia wouldn't even need nukes to defeat Ukraine and its allies. During the discussion in St. Petersburg, Putin observes, Russia has more tactical nukes than there are on the European continent, even if the United States were to bring theirs over. He further explained to Russian foreign policy expert Sergei Kharaganov that Europe does not have a developed early warning system. In this sense, they are more or less defenseless. Meanwhile, Putin's not ruling out changes to Russian nuclear doctrine, which outlines the conditions for their use of nuclear weapons. This doctrine is a living tool. We're carefully watching what's happening in the world around us. We do not exclude making changes to the doctrine. The St. Petersburg Forum, often referred to as the Russian Davos, is widely seen as a sign the country is open to cooperation. Russia remains under heavy worldwide sanctions because of the war in Ukraine, where those sanctions have created chaos economically because they now perceive that the dollar can be manipulated to be a weapon of politics, and other nations don't want to be subject to the kind of pressure those sanctions represent, seeing how they have been imposed upon Russia. Notwithstanding, of course, Russia is thriving, flourishing, the ruble at an all-time high, BRICS developing. Even Saudi Arabia is giving up the use of the dollar for oil transactions. NATO has now allowed Ukraine use Western-supplied weapons to hit targets inside Russian territory. We are not supplying those weapons yet, observed Putin, but we reserve the right to do so in states or legal entities under pressure, including military, from the countries that supply weapons to Ukraine. and encourage their use on Russian territory. As President Putin has made clear, we'll investigate these issues. If you're trying to harm us, you have to be pretty sure we have sufficient opportunity and chances to harm you. This was being told to a Russian state TV host by a Russian state TV host, Vladimir Soloviov, who rejected the argument such saber rattling is a bluff. It's always a bluff until the time when it is not. You can keep thinking Russia is bluffing, and then one day, poof, there's no more Great Britain to laugh at. Don't you ever try to push a Russian bear thinking that, oh, it's a kitten and we can play with it. Even Jen Stoltenberg acknowledges Russia has exceeded NATO's expectations. Speaking to Sky News, Jen Stoltenberg was asked to comment on a study released last month by the consulting firm Bain & Company, revealing Moscow was generating artillery shells at more than three times the rate of all NATO members combined. It's correct that Russia has been able to build up their defense industry faster than we expected. And it's correct that NATO allies have spent more time than they should in wrapping up our production. The reason Western nations have lagged behind is that after the Cold War, meaning after the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991, we actually built down our defense industry. However, according to Stoltenberg, the situation is now improving, with all the NATO allies increasing their capacity to produce ammunition and weapons. There were delays and gaps in deliveries to Kiev in recent months, but this is really changing, and the flow of ammunition into Ukraine has increased over the last few weeks. Russia's advances in Kharkov demonstrate the need for us to step up our support for Kiev, the Secretary General of NATO added. This support will continue even if former President Trump wins the election in November, because it's in the interest of both Europe and the U.S., Stoltenberg insisted. I add absurdly, it is most certainly not in the interest of U.S. or the United States to engage in a nuclear war with Russia, which is inevitable if we continue to poke the bear. Scott Ritter predicting it could happen as early as within the next week or so, mid-June. Trump has expressed skepticism on donating arms to Ukraine, arguing the U.S. should stop giving foreign aid unless it's structured as a loan, insisting the bulk of the support should come from Europe. Trump remembers a businessman. He likes to conduct business. Business is successful when it's not hostile. He's a good man for dealing with many of these issues. A Russian victory over Ukraine will make the world more dangerous and us more vulnerable, insists Stoltenberg. But it's not at all obvious that that is the case. The paper by Bain & Company said Russian factories are projected to make or refurbish approximately 4.5 million artillery rounds this year, compared to the West's combined output of about 1.3 million. The figures given by the firm also suggest the average production cost of a 152-millimeter shell from Moscow runs about $1,000, while the price of the 155-millimeter rounds used by NATO is up to $4,000. In late May, Russian President Putin said domestic ammo output had increased by a factor of 14. Drone manufacturers, a fourfold surge. The assembly of tanks and armored vehicles, risen by a factor of 3.5 since the outbreak of the conflict. Here we have some reflections from Colonel McGregor on the current state of affairs.
Could the United States Army be destined for a war against Russia? It's hard to even imagine. I'm saying that, and it's not just some hyperbole or some just crazy statement, but it's becoming more and more real, something that has to be given legitimate shot. It shouldn't happen this way. There should be even no consideration of this, but the facts on the ground are requiring it. Earlier today, there was an article in the Telegraph, which was titled NATO Land Corridor Could Rush U.S. Troops to Frontline in Event of European War with Russia. Now, listen, that is just a crazy thing to think of, that the U.S. military, the U.S. Army in particular, could fight the Russian army in this current environment here. Now, of course, the bigger threat is, and the more troubling threat, is if there was a nuclear confrontation between the two sides. But let's look at the situation, what might happen if what's depicted in this Telegraph article were to come into vogue and to happen, and the U.S. Army would go in there. Now, I've fought in several deployments in my time, to include large-scale tank-on-tank warfare in the past. And one of my commanders at that time was then Major Doug McGregor, who's now retired colonel, of course. You know him very well. He's been on our show many times. That guy literally wrote the book on how to do future war, how the modern wars can fight based on things that had happened in the past and the capabilities, how to project these things out. So I wanted to bring him in to talk about this, because there's nobody better, I promise you. He was not available today to come on camera, but he was able to come on the telephone. So I had him on earlier today on a recording so that we can bring it to you live right now. And I'm telling you, this is something you need to pay a lot of attention to. I always want to bring you quality programming here, but this thing here with Doug, is he brings up some incredibly salient points. And the bottom line that, as you're about to hear, is that the United States Army is nowhere near as capable as to what people think it is. And our policymakers, especially the president in Washington, needs to pay a lot of attention to this, because if he even has any fantasies about engaging in a land warfare against Russia, he needs to rethink. And here's the reason why. I'm going to talk specifically about some things. And Doug, actually, I'm going to read a part here from your book, Margin of Victory, because I think that it's very, very much appropriate for what we're going to discuss today. And if I can just bring this up, there it is right here. You wrote that each chapter of this book is going to be a clarion call to recognize that wars are decided in the decades before they begin, not by the sudden appearance of a new technological silver bullet or presence of a few strong personalities in the senior ranks during a senior battle. How effectively national, political, and military leaders adjust the framework of organization, technology, and human capital to relentless change in society, technology, and world affairs determines whether the nation state prevails or perishes in defeat. So if that be true, if basically what you were doing in the decade before the battle is what's going to determine how you do in the battle, the question is going to be, what is the United States Army going to do if it goes into a full-scale war with Russia right now? And just to kind of set the stage, there's news out that NATO is looking at how it would rush large numbers of American troops if we got into a ground war with Russia. And for the purpose of this conversation, we're going to say that it doesn't go nuclear. If it just stays conventional, I want to look at what might happen with that. Nukes is a very possibility, and that can go elsewhere. But I want to discuss, first of all, what could the U.S. Army do? And first of all, I want to ask you, over the past decade, let's just look at the premise of your book. If we look back the past decade, going back to 2014, the U.S. military primarily has had experience in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, in Somalia, several places like that, all small-scale stuff. So if that's what we have prepared up to this point, What kind of army do we have right now if we had to fight a large-scale army?
Well, first, we have a very small army. We're down to less than about 450,000. We're in no position to fight a land war in Eastern Europe, which has a front of hundreds of miles and a depth of 1,000 miles at least. The infrastructure in the theater is not developed beyond Germany. There's surprisingly little in Poland. So the point is, I can't imagine the use of the United States Army to do much more than potentially defend. And you're talking about offensive operations because you have to move into Eastern Europe. Now, having said that, remember that the vast majority of the equipment that the Army is using and the organization that we see on the battlefield today was developed in the 70s and the 80s for use in the 90s. And we're now in the year 2024. We're talking about a very different mix of technologies, different organizational constructs. The Russians have adapted. They've had to adapt because they were thrust into a war for which they, too, were really not prepared. You'll recall when the Russians first went into Ukraine, their force was too small, wasn't really organized to deal with the robust Ukrainian army. All of that has changed. So on the tactical level, we're an anachronism. We're not really prepared. We don't have sufficient air defense and missile defense capabilities, which would mean that we're naked in the face of the enemy. In other words, the Russians. Now, having said that, the RUSI in London just published a report saying that the combined air defenses in Western Europe could protect at most 5% of the infrastructure.
Yeah, I just saw that, actually.
Which puts us in a very difficult position. Now, let's start at the top. Strategically, we're operating on the opponent's doorstep, where the opponent has every advantage logistically, in terms of range, weapons, ammunition, resupply, and so forth. We're at the end right now in Poland on the border with Ukraine of our logistical support structure. Now you want to move this Lilliputian force, frankly, into an area where it'll face probably 800,000 Russian troops. You have the same thing with the Europeans. The worst part is that our force has very little unity of command, which means no unity of effort. Why? Because we're dealing with multiple foreign contingents. The Russians have one language of command, Russian. They have one uniform command and control structure, and they have both operational as well as strategic ISR. Our strategic ISR in space is very formidable. We do have operational ISR from the fleet as well as the shore, but it's very vulnerable to attack. The one area where we do have an advantage is air power. We outnumber the numbers of Russian aircraft that could be hurled against us by 5, 6, 7 times. However, we would have to fight our way through integrated air defenses. That would involve some losses. We have to fly from vulnerable airfields that are relatively close to the battlefront because they're short-range fighters.
And Doug, let me just, as you're talking right now, I have a map on the screen that shows from the Telegraph, which was talking about there would be 5 different locations from Norway, Germany, Italy, Turkey, the Netherlands and Italy down in the south, actually, where they would come into. It shows relatively limited or narrow constrained areas here. And in that same article, because I think this is related to exactly what you're talking about, Lieutenant General Solfrank, who's the NATO logistics chief, makes the point here, and this is something you've been really talking about for decades, frankly, is that the vulnerability of these large logistics bases and these large concentrations of troops and equipment, et cetera, that we did like in Desert Storm. We had these huge bases that were never touched. But he's saying that because of the Russia's long-range missile systems now, that's a thing of the past. But here's the big problem. All we've ever done is practice with these large scale movements. What kind of difficulties would we have moving in these 5 directions to even try to get to the battlefront?
Well, you look at the distances that are on the map. You're talking about hundreds of kilometers. In other words, 150, 200, 300 miles, trying to operate in areas where you don't have nearly enough pre-positioned ammunition supplies, and yet we haven't even talked about medical evacuation. All of those things are a nightmare. We're simply not prepared to launch offensive operations into Eastern Europe. If you go back to 1941, very rapidly the Germans discovered they were on a front of 1,100 miles with about anywhere from 600 to 1,000 miles deep. We're not prepared for that. We don't have the numbers. We don't have the logistical infrastructure. And as you point out, the air power has to be positioned forward. If it's forward, it's going to be vulnerable. We haven't even discussed something else, which has to be mentioned. And if we've listened to the Russians over the last several weeks, repeatedly, they've said, look, if you attack us on our soil, if you launch strikes against us, we reserve the right to return the favor with tactical nuclear weapons. Now, very specifically, we're very reliant on F-15s. The F-15 is a brilliant aircraft, fighter, bomber, and the Russians know that it is capable of carrying and launching nuclear weapons. This is the same thing with B-52s. If the Russians see large numbers of F-15s headed in their direction, and we would use large numbers of aircraft because we're not going to allow our forces to go forward into Ukraine without air cover, then the Russians would feel probably compelled to immediately attack all of those airfields and airports with tactical nuclear weapons. Why bother with conventional weapons? One or two tactical nuclear weapons of 5 kiloton or less will annihilate the airfields in the space of an hour. And why would you wait around for us to attack and destroy them? So I think it's not just conventional. They definitely have the edge in conventional military power. But why risk the arrival of F-15s with nuclear weapons over your soil? I don't think the Russians would do that. I think the Russians are telling us they're ready. And remember, the Russians have a battle-hardened force. They've been fighting for several years. They've eliminated a lot of weak officers, weak commanders at every level. We have no such experience. If you go, as you mentioned earlier, Dan, if you go back over the last 30 years, when have we relieved anyone in the field for failure to perform? Well, if you're performing against opponents that have no armies, no air forces, no naval forces, the general officer is really never tested. And the troops rely excessively on firepower as opposed to maneuver. There's no agility in terms of thinking and behavior. There's no experience to base anything on. So the Russians have a decided advantage strategically, operationally, and tactically. I don't think we can overcome those.
Doug, let me ask you this question, because I remember.
Let me just say, Colonel McGregor nails it again and again. The Russians have all the advantages. They have the closest supply lines, no logistic problems. They're outproducing the West militarily by many orders of magnitude. They have a hard military. We have a Lilliputian force by comparison that's gone woke. Our people are more experienced in dealing with diversity issues and transgenderism than they are in actually conducting combat. Have no doubt, in a conventional war, it would be impossible for the West even to have all the American military forces at its disposal to defeat Russia. It's impossible. What that means is, if the West is going to launch an attack, it has to be nuclear. And I reiterate what many commentators have observed before. Russia has superior ICBMs. Russia has superior anti-missile missiles. Russia has superior anti-ship missiles. Russia has superior anti-submarine torpedoes. The Russians know their existence depends upon their ability to conduct warfare. They have been lean and mean. They're military-industrial complex operates to benefit Russia. The American, to fatten their pocketbook. They even put out deliberately inferior arms, so just as Bill Gates learned with Windows. If it's defective, then you can get additional contracts for new versions or for maintenance contracts and double or triple your profits. They have never had the national interests of America at heart. With the Russians, it's been completely the opposite. Now, mind you, the situation is developing, even in Israel, where it grows worse and worse virtually by the day as the genocide continues. Thus, most recently, 4 hostages were freed, but at the cost of 274 Palestinians killed. As antiwar.com observes, if you have to kill 274 to free 4 female hostages, is that a success? According to the Israeli and U.S. governments, it is. Israel, with a little help from the United States, attacked the Nusrat camp in Gaza, freeing 4 hostages seized by Hamas. In doing so, however, Israeli forces killed and wounded hundreds of unarmed men, women, and children. It's a brutal calculus that sees Palestinians as being in the way, essentially as worthless and therefore expendable. Put differently, Israel sees all Palestinians as guilty, as terrorists. Therefore, there are no innocent Palestinians. Israel can kill as many as they need without guilt or remorse to achieve its desired end. Coverage by the mainstream in the West has been glowing, praising Israel for rescuing 4 while downplaying the Palestinian dead as collateral damage, hardly worth a mention. Here's a BBC story about it. Big caps. 4 hostages seized at Nova Festival freed in Gaza. Small type. Hamas claims more than 200 Palestinians were killed in the densely populated area where the raid took place. You see a happy young woman freed by Israeli forces. You don't see any images of the more than 200 Palestinians killed by Israel. Note how the Palestinian dead are consigned to a subheading in smaller font, using a passive voice, were killed, as if it's unclear who killed them and why. Yes, it's good to see 4 hostages freed, but if hundreds of other innocent must die or suffer grievous wounds in the process, that's not a successful operation. It's a massacre. Meanwhile, Red Crescent says the Israeli troops came in an aid truck to free the hostages. Jerusalem. The Palestinian Red Crescent said Monday Israeli troops used an aid drum to infiltrate central Gaza's Nusrat camp, where they rescued 4 Israeli hostages over the weekend. I'd observe, this is a violation of the laws of war. This is a violation of the Geneva Convention. This is a violation of the United Nations Charter. The Red Cross local Palestinian branch said it warned of the danger of occupation forces' use of such a vehicle to infiltrate the camp. The occupation forces deceive people by disguising themselves under the cover of aid civilians desperately need amid their suffering from severe food insecurity. They're starving. Severe food insecurity is quite the euphemism. They are being deliberately starved to death. This endangers the safety of relief teams, to put it mildly. Such a precedent raises the prospect of humanitarian aid workers being perceived with suspicion in the future. Asked about the Red Crescent statement, the Israeli army referred to a June 8 tweet where a spokesman dismissed such allegations as lies. Well, we know who lies. and we know who speaks the truth. Virtually every single claim made by the Palestinian side has turned out to be true. Virtually every allegation or defense advanced by Israel has turned out to be false. 4 hostages held in Gaza since October 7th were released. Amag Mirjan, 22, Noah Argamani, 26, Andrei Keslov, 27, and Shalomi Ziv, 41, were kidnapped from the Nova Festival on October 7th. Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry said at least 274 Palestinians had been killed. Meanwhile, the Cradle reports, Israel perpetrated the Nuseirat massacre to block a ceasefire deal with Hamas. Ismail Haniyeh, head of the Hamas Movement Political Bureau, said Israel launched its bloody massacre to block a ceasefire deal. Speaking with Al Jazeera Arabic on 10 June about the U.S. proposed ceasefire deal and prospects for ending the war, Haniyeh said Israel attacked the Nuseirat camp, killing at least 274 Palestinians and retrieving 4 Israeli captives to block any agreement that would end the war. Israeli forces bombed various civilian areas of Gaza from the air to create chaos and pave the way, while executing Palestinians in cold blood in their homes where no Israeli captives were present. He also accused the U.S. of being a part of the attack, that the Biden White House is no less criminal than the Israeli leadership, with which I completely agree. Sunday, U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said the U.S. offered help with the rescue, but did not specify how. A senior White House official said the operation will likely complicate efforts to reach a ceasefire and captive exchange between Israel and Hamas. The freeing of the 4 Israeli captives has strengthened Prime Minister Netanyahu's determination to continue pursuing military operations rather than agreeing to a ceasefire. Before Saturday's massacre, the U.S. had been pushing Israeli officials to accept a ceasefire proposal announced by President Biden on 31 May. U.S. officials claim Israel put forward the proposal, but Netanyahu and other ministers stated they would refuse any deal that would force them to permanently end their 7-month bombing and demolition campaign in the besieged Gaza Strip. Have no doubt about it. For Israel, the final solution to the Palestinian problem would be to load all the Palestinians aboard a ship, float it out to sea, and sink it. Absent that alternative, they're doing their best to kill or expel every single Palestinian from Palestine. The situation is completely outrageous. As one of the callers to my radio show on RBN has observed, paralleling Trump's motto, Make America Great Again, he proposed, Make Israel Palestine Again, with which I 100% agree. Israel has no legitimate claim to the lands of Palestine. That's been made clear already by the International Court of Justice and brilliant critiques of the absence of a legal foundation for establishing the apartheid state of Israel. Have no doubt, it's a Jewish state that treats those of other ethnic orientation with gross discrimination, just as apartheid as was South Africa in its time. And by choice, Israel voted within the last 15 years or so between becoming a Jewish state and a democratic state, and they chose to be a Jewish state. There's nothing going on here that has anything to do with freedom or democracy. Meanwhile, Europe appears to be rebelling. Macron has dissolved parliament after an humiliating defeat by the French right. French President Emmanuel Macron has dissolved the French National Assembly, called a snap election in response to his humiliating defeat in the European election. The decision is a significant gamble that could backfire spectacularly for him because the outcome may be even more overwhelmingly negative for him. In preliminary results from the European election, Marine Le Pen's National Rally have won 30 seats with 31.5% of the vote, a stunning victory for the French right. By contrast, Macron's Renaissance Party managed to secure just 15.2% of the vote, less than half. Macron addressed the French people directly as the scale of the defeat became clear. "I have decided to give you back the choice of our parliamentary future through the vote. I am dissolving the National Assembly this evening. The first round of election is set for June 30th, the second July 7th. Macron referred to his decision as serious and weighty, but it is, before all, an act of confidence. The result in Macron's announcement of a snap election were greeted with jubilation by Marie Le Pen and her supporters. We're ready for power if French people put their trust in us, Le Pen said. Le Pen observed her party had won because it best represented France and the concerns of ordinary French people, which are immigration, inflation, the cost of living and crime, and, of course, the war in Ukraine. For Emmanuel Macron has declared he's sending French forces to fight there. When the people vote, the people win. Her party's victory is expected to be a prelude to an even greater victory in the national election. The party is already the largest opposition party in parliament with 88 members. It's going to be very hard to stop us now, said a National Rally senator. We're everywhere now. There's no more fortress impossible for us to take. We have voters in every sector of life, every profession. If Macron should be roundly defeated in the national election, which I predict, his legislative agenda will be stymied for his final 2 years in office, and he will be unable to run for re-election in 2027 because of term limits. Meanwhile, far-right gains in the EU election deal stunning defeats of Francis Macron and Germany Schultz, another supporter of the Ukraine war. Sensing a threat from the far right, the Christian Democrats of EU Commissioner President Ursula von der Leyen had already shifted further to the right on immigration and climate ahead of the elections and were rewarded. I remain by far the biggest group in the 720-seat European Parliament and de facto brokers of the ever-expanding powers of the legislature. Undoubtedly, however, the star on a stunning electoral night was a National Rally Party of Marine Le Pen, which dominated the French polls to such an extent Macron immediately dissolved the national parliament and called for new elections. It was a massive political risk, since his party could suffer more losses, hobbling the rest of his term, which ends in 2027. Le Pen was delighted to accept the challenge. We're ready to turn the country around, ready to defend the interests of the French, ready to put an end to mass immigration, echoing the rallying cry of so many far-right leaders in other countries who are also celebrating substantial wins. Meanwhile, Brussels, far-right parties rattled the traditional powers in the European Union and made major gains in parliamentary elections Sunday, dealing an especially humiliating defeat of French President Emmanuel Macron. On a night where the 27-member bloc palpably shifted to the right. Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni more than doubled her seats in the EU Parliament. And even the Alternative for Germany, extreme right party, was hounded by scandal involving candidates. It still rallied enough seats to sweep past the slumping Social Democrats of Chancellor Olaf Scholz. Meanwhile, the former ambassador to Germany, Rick Grinnell, observes, EU enthrones an immigration revolt. Former ambassador to Germany, Rick Grinnell, said the United States should heed what's happening across Europe, telling Newsmax it's a backlash in progressive and woke policies. And I dare say add, though these stories aren't emphasizing, to the pro-Ukraine war policies that have been advocated by their leaders. Fed up European set progressives packing in parliamentary election the past 4 days, replacing traditional power brokers with conservatives. French President Macron dissolved parliament, called for snap national elections in 3 weeks. Grinnell joined Rob Schmidt tonight to say the revolts across Western Europe could be a harbinger of things to come for the United States. Fed up Americans could drive President Biden out of the White House in November in favor of Donald Trump and his policies. You don't need a crystal ball to make that prediction. You really have to look at what's happening in Europe and realize progressive policies are under attack. People realize the woke left, where they put together their governments and put together their policies, they can't produce, Grinnell told Schmidt. People are unhappy. The economy's tanked. So you look from Germany to France to Belgium. Everywhere, there's a Republican conservative style sweep. Now, I hope that's going to happen in our country as well, but we've got some work to do. The Europeans have watched inflation take over. They've watched their economies go to the bottom. Suddenly, now you have countries like France that are scaring Macron because the conservatives are marching toward a takeover and he just called for elections. He's that scared. Grinnell also highlighted the rise of the ultra-conservative Alternative for Germany, now the second largest party in Germany. What's happening in Europe is really a backlash. And remember, the European Union became smaller because of Brexit. The British said, we're out of here, because the rest of Europe couldn't control the immigration issue. We need to learn from the Europeans on immigration. Our leader cannot handle the immigration issue in a proper way. The people revolt. I think we're seeing that in America as well. Grinnell spoke of illegal immigration in the United States, reacting to a weekend poll showing 62% of Americans across a political spectrum want illegals booted from the country. Grinnell, who would figure to have a prominent role in a new Trump administration, carries a basic approach to it. I view it as enforcing the law. If someone has broken the law, then they need to have consequences for that. We have rules. And so, when we find people who have broken the rule, who have cut the line, who are unvetted, of course, we have to kick them out. We have to get people out of this country who broke our laws. The Department of State does it every single day. It's also about being very realistic about those people waiting. I know people who've been waiting years, spending lots of money on attorneys, waiting in line, doing the right thing to get a green card. We owe it to the people who have followed the rules to make sure the rule breakers have punishment for what they have done. Let me say, I regard immigration as by far the biggest issue. But the lawlessness that has consumed the country, inflation, economic meltdown, the destruction of the middle class are all taking a toll. I believe anti-war sentiment is growing in this country, and the way in which student protesters are being abused is tragic. I'm hoping against hope that Donald Trump can rise to the occasion and, contrary to some of his most recent pronouncements, which seem to provide wholehearted support for genocide, if only it's carried out faster. His only complaint seeming to be that the Israelis aren't killing the Palestinians fast enough, that he could become a president for all of America, that he could stand up for the Constitution, that he could assert the primacy of the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, the right to peaceably assemble for redress of grievances. I have no doubt, for all my misgivings about his attitude toward Israel and his failure to stand up for the Palestinians, that Donald Trump is going to experience a landslide re-election. I frankly believe, in spite of the Democrats' best efforts, it's going to be all but impossible to deny him that outcome. His rallies around the country are drawing massive support, even in areas like the Bronx, out in Las Vegas, even in California. It's Trump, Trump, Trump. The crowds are fed up with Biden. Most don't even realize it's not even the real Joe who appears to have died in 2017. But will we get there? Will we make it to November 5th? I believe Russia ought to demonstrate its seriousness by declaring its intention to strike NATO headquarters in Brussels at a specific date and time. Notify NATO in advance. Have them evacuate the building. Have them prepare their best anti-missile defense. And Russia, with one of its hypersonic missiles, will take it out. Maybe that will be the equivalent of a glass of ice water in the face of the politicians in Europe and America who are so enthusiastic about going to war with Russia, because I guarantee that would be a war we could not win. The only outcome acceptable is that it should not be fought at all. Listen to Colonel McGregor. All the king's horses, all the king's men. We cannot cope with Russia militarily or even economically. America is falling apart. All the sanctions on Russia have redounded to Russia's benefit. The ruble is stronger than ever. BRICS is becoming more and more powerful. The petrodollar is on the verge of extinction. We need to take care of matters at home and follow the Founding Fathers' advice to not become engaged in foreign entanglements. When will we learn? If we're lucky, it won't be too late. We look forward to Scott Bennett's return, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to share these programs with you.